Digital transformation is a bit of a buzzword, and it may have been whittled down to near meaningless by now. Digital transformation has been used to mean internet-enabled crockpots, creating a hashtag movement on your Snapstagram, and collapsing your data center and moving everything to the cloud. That last one might seem like a great idea, but just pushing your heritage application to the cloud is not going to digitally transform your company any more than slapping an Autobot symbol on my car makes it a transformer. How do you actually move a workload to the public cloud? What are the pitfalls and gotchas? Why did we get a whole movie about Bumblebee and not about jazz? Let's dive into the world of cloud migrations to find out. Welcome to Day 2 Cloud, a frank discussion of what happens when cloud stops being polite and starts getting real. This is episode 7, and I am your host, Ned Bellavance, Ned1313 on the Twitters. My guest today is Martin Ernst. He is a 15-year IT veteran working for Intility, a managed service provider in Norway, where he focuses on Azure as a whole, but mainly in the monitoring and management platforms like Log Analytics and Azure Monitor. Welcome to the show, Martin.
Thank you.
Today, we're going to do something a little bit different with our format. Usually, we try to talk about the plan in the first half and then the reality in the second half. But, Martin, you suggested that we could split the conversation into your experience working with startups versus large companies. And in my consulting experience, I've definitely seen that the needs of different sized companies differ greatly, as does the way in which you need to interact with them. So, why don't we first focus on startups? What has been your experience working with startups in the cloud?
Yeah, so thank you for having me on the show in the first place. The reason I wanted to talk about the startups versus public cloud, or the large companies and enterprises versus public cloud, is that in many terms they are exactly the same when it comes to implementing or govern their public cloud, but it starts from a different perspective. So the startups are mainly tech-savvy companies, and it's driven by a young CEO or a group of developers or something like that. And they start off by using all the new technology and pushing their teams hard to deliver new features and stuff like that at a rapid scale. And the challenge is that when the company grows and the technology they're developing grows and they start getting actual customers, the customer starts to demand something with how do you govern your, how is this service provided to us, and how, who has access to what, and how is and stuff like that.
I see a lot of startups, you know, they're, the whole ethos is rushing to get MVP, you know, minimal viable product, out the door so you can start you know, growing and getting customers. But then those customers might have questions about how you built that product in the first place, right?
Correct. So I have, we have one customer who started off like that, and they come to us with a few years ago. They was just, okay, we built this stuff on Kubernetes, and if it's bleeding edge from end to end. And then they onboarded a large customer, and then they didn't care about if it was built on Docker containers or if it was built on serverless, or, and they were just, is it ISO certified, or do you have access control, who, and all that other stuff, which basically they don't know anything about. So they just came right out of school and had this great idea to produce some software, right? So that's one, let's call it an issue, when you have the power of the hyperscale cloud. You can just put on any workload you want, but you still have to govern and actually do your operations on this application or applications.
So with that in mind, did you assist them with setting up some of those, you know, governance guardrails and setting up access policies and maybe gaining a certification?
Yeah, it started off like by just defining the simplest things, like, do you have MFA enabled? And there was like, oh, no, not all of us have MFA, and we don't know how to. I don't know who has MFA or who hasn't MFA. So it started off with the basic simple stuff that you always, as an operations guy, I come from an operations team and always working with the Active Directory people. And then it's in my blood to have proper access control. But these guys was just pushing out with credentials over the place. So they started off with the basics, and after that we have added policies and sideloading different ARM templates and stuff like that for their Azure environments.
Okay, I want to dig into that a little bit more. So when you say sideloading and the ARM templates, mm-hmm. can you expand on that a little bit more? That I'm curious what you mean by that.
Yeah, because now they have the company in that particular company, so eventually they onboarded our let's say the management platform. So we are now managing their environment. So we have their laptops. We are managing everything from their laptops to the infrastructure environment. So, mm-hmm. and they have some services running on in our data centers, but we are kind of agnostic to where the workloads run. So since they were aiming for a global customer base, they put all the actual product application into Azure. So, and then since we are we are responsible for the 24/7 operations team, so to say, and they can call our support. Not the end user, not their end customers can call our support, but their applications team can call our support 24/7, and we. Since our customers are not 24/7 operations, they can opt in for our service to be to watch for their application and how it performs. And in order to do that, we don't necessarily want to we need the customer or their teams, developer teams, to be agile all the way, so they have to provision. New services and features as fast as they can, but for each deployment, let's say they provision a new virtual machine. I don't know why they should do that since they are running in AKS, but let's say if they provision a new virtual machine, we will sideload an ARM template through a policy or something like that. So we are able to do our monitoring and stuff. So if they don't have, let's say the correct log analytics workspace to forward all the logs in their deployment pipeline, we always configure that with our own pipeline, so to say. So we always are a little bit behind, but 5 minutes of data is probably good.
Okay. So
I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. So you're monitoring their environment, and if they create new resources that don't have the correct governance things in place or the correct logging, you can run an additional ARM template on top of that that will apply the proper governance and kind of keep them in line. Is that the idea?
Yeah. Yeah. So they are allowed to do whatever they want in their tests and dev environment, but as long as they are actually pushing to production, we have Azure policies and we have sideloading of ARM templates each time they're provisioning a new workload, just to make sure that we have the correct logging information, and the web apps are always deployed with the same Azure Monitor alerts, for example.
Yeah. Sure. And so how do you detect when a change has been made to production to know to enforce those ARM templates, the sideloading?
It depends. In some cases, we have built it into the pipeline. So it's just each time they run their build pipelines, we are included in step So just another new step for that pipeline, or we're using straight out Azure policies, and starting to experiment with blueprints as well, to move that side loading of ARM templates and stuff from the pipeline to blueprints instead.
So one of the things that you mentioned, in addition to getting to minimum viable product and credentials management, is scaling. So when startups start getting a bunch of customers, or they get that first one large customer, they're going to have to deal with scaling. So have you seen some interesting issues with that?
Yeah, one of the things that we talked about, prior to recording now, is that the scene of who is running operations and who is running dev hasn't actually changed. The only thing that's changed is the platform, right? Mm-hmm. So what I've seen multiple times is that when we onboard a typical startup or tech savvy small companies who are agile and have a lot of young guys who's great developers and technical as they can be, it's they have no experience with the platform itself. So when operations back in the days were actually putting in a physical server in a rack, they have done that, and they have provisioned new virtual machines, and now the operations guys need to scale Azure as a cloud, and then you need platform knowledge. So developers have knowledge about the, let's say, Kubernetes clusters, so to say, and then they are fine with scaling their individual apps or pods or whatever it is called. But let's say they have web applications, just to reference web apps in Azure, they have no knowledge in how to, or little knowledge in how the platform works in terms of scaling. So if you have an SLA and you said that 90% of my users' requests should be served within 0.5 seconds, right? And Azure has a platform capability to do that, the monitoring and the auto scale, but you need the operations teams to actually put that in motion, because in many cases, the developers has no knowledge on how the actual platform works in terms of what operations capabilities do we have and stuff like that. So that's what we see. It's a common thing.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting mix, because especially I feel like startups tend to be very dev heavy and don't have a lot of infrastructure or cloud experience. So even if they're running just Kubernetes as opposed to one of the sort of platform as a service things, they still may not understand how to scale Kubernetes or monitor it from an operational perspective. They might just know, okay, I run Minikube locally, and I send out some deployments and run some services, and oh, that all works great. I can wire that up in AKS, no problem. But yeah, day two, how do I monitor that? Where do I store my state, and how do I expand it? So I'm sure they're dealing with those kinds of questions.
Exactly. So you have, I'm not a Kubernetes or AKS expert, but I know it's the concept of different scaling internally in the cluster. So you can have, it's called pods, isn't it? Each individual application it runs. So it will scale each individual application into multiple pods, but you also have to scale the actual underlying VMs to handle the amount of pods you're running. Right. So you have multiple layers of scaling. That it depends on where the dev or the operations teams have their responsibilities, but it tends to be, as long as you're out of the actual Kubernetes cluster, you're definitely over to what the operations team is specializing in. So IT pros are still valuable to the organization, for sure.
Right. It can't be a dev only world. As much as I've heard from AWS developers all the time. No, you still need those. You still need those IT ops guys giving you a hand, even in the cloud, surprisingly. So that's sort of the perspective of startups. Why don't we dive into the world of larger companies, enterprises, and government who have a very different economic model, a different approach, and different requirements. So tell me a little bit about your experience there.
So you're from the United States. I don't know how things work with government owned. Do you have government owned companies kind of acting like private held companies?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting mix. So we have, you know, government agencies that mm-hmm. are, you know, beholden to what the government says. And then there's a lot of suppliers and partners that work with government. So they are restricted by the compliance and requirements of whatever branch of the government they are working with. I mean, for instance, my brother-in-law works with the Navy, and he's responsible for quality assurance. And so he works with a whole bunch of different partners to make sure that the fabrics and materials that they're using in their products that are being used by the Navy meet those QA standards that he set out. So it's an interesting interplay between the two.
Yeah. So it's worse, a little bit different, but somewhat the same in Norway. So it's a you have large companies, and then you have, which is fully privately owned, and then you have kind of like partially government-owned companies. So it could be the local transport kind of buses system and stuff like that could mm-hmm. be partially owned by the local government. And those kind of companies are always pitched from the cloud vendors, from politicians and stuff like that, that you need to, in order to survive, we need to digitalize your business, right?
Right.
And then they are, they have, let's say they have 1,000 employees or 20,000 employees. It doesn't actually matter, but it's a large company, and they are many people working there. And that's my key point. It's that it's not just employees, it's actually people who works in these organizations, and they all have a job, right? And I believe that that's where you need to start your digitalization, because it doesn't matter if you have one person sitting in the corner actually sending out invoices via his own Outlook or something like that. It's mm-hmm. you have to start your digitalization within your own company or within your own team. But what we tend to see is that they actually hire in a team of really, really bright people who are starting their own digitalization kind of department and forget how the rest of the organization works. So they kind of close the door and says, hey, don't enter, we are actually doing digitalization over here, so you can go back to your desk and do whatever you want,
right?
and you have like someone sitting in the corner actually sending out invoices or scanning invoices and stuff like that. So that's what we see often, and I think that it's because politicians and government is pushing hard on digitalization, and they don't know what it means in many cases. And it's a tough world, and it's a lot of money in the business, and it's my money in some cases as well, and they're often spent not wrong, but it should be put in other places to start with. So the digitalization department that pops up in these organizations are bright people, and the intentions are really, really good, but it doesn't always work when the rest of the organization is 10 years behind.
Right. That kind of reminds me of when software developers started trying to bring Agile into the workplace. And it worked really well within their small team, right? It was just, you know, a two pizza team that Amazon calls it. You know, enough. The team's only so big that two pizzas could fit, could feed them. And in those cases, it worked really well just within the team. But once they tried to expand that operation out to the rest of the company, they discovered that no one else in the company was capable of keeping the same cadence or was familiar with what's a sprint, what's a scrum, what are all these strange words you're using, you know?
Yeah, correct.
And so one of the things that we started seeing over here is that the introduction of something called scaled agile or big tent agile. And the idea is not only do you have to train your software developers in agile, but you also have to train your finance department. You have to train your IT ops folks. You have to train your procurement. All these other departments that interact with software development and the business at large need to be on that same bus. And this, what you're describing sounds very similar in the sense that if you just create one center of excellence for digitalization and don't bring anybody else into that, they're going to develop things in a bubble and what they produce probably isn't what the company actually needs.
No, exactly. So if someone actually sent back to the invoice example, if someone actually sends an invoice manually through their in their Outlook or something like that, you, it doesn't matter if you built that new web portal based on whatever buzzword you can throw at it. So it's completely serverless, and it's but it doesn't matter if the underlying organization is lacking behind and don't follow on your digitalization path. So the key is there to gather the teams and actually, if you're going to start up with a digitalization team, you need to go into the organization and actually start talking to your colleagues and see where the challenge is before you aim too big.
Yeah, so part of a successful digital transformation, if we can use that word, or cloud migration, is actually getting buy-in from all the other groups within your organization. Would that Is that kind of what you're thinking?
Yeah, correct.
So I think one of the things that people see when they see change is they feel fear that they might be displaced or replaced or, you know, made redundant. So what are some ways that you think in a big organization, the digitalization group can assure the other groups that they're not there to just put them out of a job or sideline them?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know if I'm the correct person to answer it, but I can ask you. Have you been? You have not been replaced during the cloud war, have you?
So I have not. Though I think no, being in me consulting neither. Makes it a little easier.
Yeah, I'm not in the consulting world, and I'm still not replaced by the digital transformation. Not yet, but it's a great question. And for people not necessarily working in the tech world, I can see how the question evolves as you, because each job has to change. Each line, let's call it the line workers, it's probably your job is probably going to change, but in what I see is that you actually develop new products all the way. So it doesn't matter if your old job went away because of the digital transformation, but if you actually get a new job out of it. So suddenly you have so many first line of workers actually he's responsible for all the robots line or something like that.
Yeah, the assembly line or something. Yeah.
An assembly line, yeah. So it's just a matter of down the road, someone actually going to lose their jobs. When you have autonomic vehicles and stuff like that, you will have people having trouble with that. You have driven a truck for 20 years or something like that. It's a different kind of thing, but within your organization, from my personal experience and from what I've seen, is that everyone is becoming an IT company in the end, and you're just developing new products, and then also you get a new position, right? From your old job that dies, but you're moving to a new position with a new product or something like that. So
right, yeah, and I think a good contrast there between the startup and the large corporation or the large government entity. It's really easy to shift and change the culture when you're a small startup and you're only, 10 people. It's really, really hard to change the culture of a large entity, whatever that is, because it has its own momentum. So I guess part of a successful transformation and cloud adoption is actually shifting a cultural change within your company. And making sure that you don't leave people behind, because like I said, that you think about that guy that you're talking about that just sends invoices via Outlook. He needs to be part of that conversation and understanding what his new job is going to look like and maybe getting some training on that, as opposed to just getting handed a pink slip and being out of work and having a robot replace him. You know, he's still a valuable asset to the company. I think there's probably... And feel free to express your opinion on this. There's probably a certain level of responsibility the company has to retrain people who are being displaced.
Yeah, I agree. But you have to start with actually talking to the guy who is sending out these invoices. So he might have the greatest ideas on how to transform that or modernize that kind of workload. That is to send these. He's probably wants to do something else. So if you talk to that guy, he has already thought about how he can kind of make his day even better. So
right.
I don't think that's if you start with your colleagues and ask them what are your needs and how do you want your day to be kind of modernized. I think that you will have great answers, and I think you'd have more connection to your colleagues working within your organization.
Wow, yeah, no, that's a really good point, and I think that's probably a good part to ride out on. We're coming up on time, but I want to say this has been a really interesting conversation. We started going kind of deep into the tech with Azure and App Services and Kubernetes, and then we ended up talking about changing company culture. So I guess, all of it is about managing day two and getting buy-in and expansion for your cloud and digital transformation.
I agree. So it's been great.
So if you could just summarize, the main three main points or three main takeaways that the listener should have, what would those three main takeaways be?
I would say that if you're... let's say we can start with the startups again, and then just before things get out of hand, I will probably gain myself some knowledge or hire in operations guys to handle the operations of managing a cloud, or I would seek help from a consultant or a managed provider or something like that before things get out of hand and before you have customers asking for your ISO certifications.
Right.
That's one. And within the government or whatever larger companies that actually start out with the digitalization department or transformation project or what you want to call it, I believe that since we're actually going deep into how your organization works before you start with what you think would be the end game. So if you split your digitalization department into two teams, one would look at the 10-year forecast and the other half can look at what we can do internally for, let's say, the next year or something like that. Probably the one sending out the invoices would just he just wants something to help him send them, and probably just opt in for a Power BI dashboard or something like that. And he's digitalized for the next year, right? I would think that's probably two or three takeaways that that we that I will look into, and what we see is or what I see is challenges in the modern world.
Great. If listeners want to know more about you, what you're up to, where can they find you? Where can they follow you?
It's always the Twitter. So it's at Ernst, that's E-H-R-N-S-T. And I also have a blog over at adatum.no. You know, the company from the Microsoft training material, yeah. Along with Contoso. Yeah.
Yep.
So that's where I'm most active. And you will probably find me if you need me.
Great. Yeah. And I was reading through some of your blog today, and I got to say, I really liked the posts on using PowerShell to manage Azure AD and applications, something I struggled with. And I wish I'd found that like 6 months ago. So thank you.
Yeah. I probably used a fair amount of time struggling with that as well before writing the blog post. So it's good. I'm not the only one.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Martin, for appearing on Day 2 Cloud. It was great.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to Martin for appearing on Day 2 Cloud, and thanks to you, dear listener, for tuning in. If you like the show, please subscribe and let me know on Twitter, Ned1313. If you have suggestions for future shows, I'd love to hear them. Until then, just remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.